White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. Your host for today's show is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy. So get a spot of tea, sit down and relax, because it's time for another show on the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network.
White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is Terrible Tommy right here in the bunker, right here in North Central Indiana. And it is the 3rd of February, 2017. And we're off and running here. P.O. Box 401 as usual. Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Time to get your donations in for the show. I don't advertise much. I advertise a little bit. I don't like to advertise. Maybe that's why I'm poor. I'm going to run you a little blurb from Max Kaiser, but I'm a little bit upset with Max Kaiser on Russia Today because he's had a couple of shows. He's traveling down on the East Coast, and I think he's down in North Carolina, and he's saying he's going to run for office next time around. But the problem is he's going to run in as a Democrat, and the bigger problem is he's talking about, well, there's a lot of blacks in the area and they like him. He's got a lot of support among the blacks. I'll bet he does, talking about high finance all the time. But that doesn't look too good. Anyhow, he's pretty good on the economic end, so we'll cover him with that. You see how they're hemming everybody in the country. Fewer and fewer people own houses. And the majority of people pretty soon are all going to be renters. And let me play the scam for you, how they got you rounded up, and now they're raising the rents through this Blackstone outfit, Blackstone Corporation, which you have been enslaved, boys and girls.
Kaiser, this is the Kaiser Report. You know, the New York Stock Exchange and securities industry as a whole, it's a great institution. It's raised capital for fine companies. But there are those who treat it like an open sewer, and it disgusts me. And one of those people is Blackstone Group. Abysmal, abysmal company. Stacy?
Well, Max, we're in the post-Obama era, but there were many things he left behind. Many little piles of special excrement, you might say, for the global economy and financial system. He left a treat for Blackstone Group. We don't know how much he's contributing to the Obama library, for example. This is something that Eve Smith at Naked Capitalism suggested. This was his little gift to him, a parting gift, and this is the first headline. Financialization of rents gets taxpayer guarantees. Invitation Homes, the 2012 buy-to-rent creature of private equity firm Blackstone, and now owner of 48,431 single-family homes, thus the largest landlord of single-family homes in the U.S., accomplished another feat. It obtained government guarantees for $1 billion in rental home mortgage-backed securities. And this disclosure, Max, only came in an amended S-11 filing with the SEC last week.
Right, and you know who just got a job working for Blackstone?
No, tell us.
George Osborne. Former Chancellor of the Exchequer of the UK. Again, proving that politics in the UK and in the US has just been essentially a way to burnish your resume on your way to work for financial terrorists like Blackstone. And remember, Blackstone is a group that got rich by introducing exchange-traded funds, which have added enormous risk to the system, that one day when the system crashes again because of the risk that's being added unhedged by Blackstone Group, they will get a bailout. But the people owning the ETFs will get nothing in return. So this is really a classic example, as I've described it for many years, of financial terrorism by Blackstone.
So again, as I said, this disclosure only came not from the Obama administration once they exited. They didn't leave a note and tell the American taxpayer that, oh, by the way, I had Fannie Mae the government-sponsored entity, the now the wholly government-owned entity, I had them underwrite the debt for Blackstone. Well, this came in an amended filing to their S-11 filing for the SEC because they're IPOing. So Invitation Homes bought these properties out of foreclosure and turned them into rental properties, concentrated in 12 urban areas. The IPO filing lists $9.7 billion in single-family properties and $7.7 billion in debt. Some of this debt will be refinanced with the proceeds from the sale of the $1 billion of government-guaranteed rental home mortgage securities. The government agency underwrites their debt, giving them a better credit rating, allowing them to borrow even cheaper than the ordinary citizen did. Because remember, Blackstone, what they were doing, and now others followed them. Blackstone basically was the first in this whole buying up foreclosures and renting them out. They're driving out poor families, working class families who are unable to afford the homes because Blackstone is in there with cash, basically borrowed against the government guarantees of their debt now. So it's making even home ownership even less affordable for the ordinary working class American.
Well, this is the legacy of Barack Obama. The 2008 financial crisis, instead of bailing out the debtors, he bailed out the creditors on Wall Street, including firms like Blackstone and their ilk. And what did they do with all that bailout money? They used it to increase their leverage in the economy. They used it to buy up distressed properties away from working class Americans. They used it to buy influence in Washington. And now they're using this new privileged position to rape and pillage at the most aggressive pace we've seen in history. And hopefully there'll be something done about it to either break Blackstone up, remove their license to do business. I mean, this is, again, if you are against having folks have their lives destroyed by nefarious outside influences using weapons of mass destruction, then you would be equally against firms like Blackstone using weapons of mass financial destruction, as was described by Warren Buffett himself, called these practices weapons of mass financial destruction.
Well, in this particular case, this is weapons of mass financialized destruction. This is financialization and how insane it is. But remember, Obama did this. Obama administration allowed this. So one of the theories that is always pushed, one of the arguments always pushed by the progressive media, the so-called progressive media, is that Obama was genuinely progressive, but he was just made to be less progressive because, oh, he had to be reelected, and also, well, there was that the Republicans in Congress were just so difficult to deal with. Well, here, this is something he did. He didn't have to do this. He could have chosen to do something different. He could have said no to Blackstone Group when they were asking for this underwriting. But this is the first time ever that a government-sponsored enterprise has guaranteed single-family rental home mortgage-backed securities issued by a huge corporate landlord. It is an essential step forward in financializing rents. Taxpayer backing for funding the biggest landlords.
Right, so they're feeding this next bubble. The next financial crash is now baked into the cake. And Blackstone wants to get as much money as they possibly can, and as quickly as they can, grab, grab, grab. They're like a little parasite of the global shving-shving, and they're just eating, and they're grabbing, and they're gouging, and they're stealing, and they're malfeasancing. And then when it all crashes, they'll be like, oh, darlings, would you please send over $1 trillion for our bailout, please? We seem to have gone belly up. And then hopefully Trump will say, you know, Guantanamo Bay is still open, and waterboarding is still happening, except worse. And we'd like Schwartz, I believe his name is Stephen Schwartz.
Schwartzman.
We'd like to waterboard him to within an inch of his life, and then, go from there.
You mentioned the bailouts because, of course, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are the two government-sponsored entities that backed all the mortgages in the U.S., and then it went belly up. And the bonds backing all those mortgages said that they would not receive a government bailout, but they did. There was just a recent budget study done about in August, where they found that basically if a financial crisis happens again, the taxpayer will be on the hook for $127 billion for Freddie Mac and something like $50 or $60 billion for Fannie Mae. So the taxpayer is on the hook for almost $200 billion, with another billion, right? But not all of this government backing will be guaranteed by the government. To satisfy credit risk retention requirements, Invitation Homes would purchase and retain the subordinate non-guaranteed certificates amounting to 5% or $50 million of the $1 billion in securities. That's all the cushion the taxpayer has before losses begin to hit home, so to speak.
Look, I mean, it's the Federal Reserve Bank is leveraged 60 to 1. If the government bond market even takes a 2% hit, the Federal Reserve Bank is insolvent. And so banks on Wall Street, like Blackstone, they look at that and say, look, I mean, the government's 60 to 1 leveraged, and they've put a stick of dynamite underneath every stock exchange in the world and the global economy. We want to put the same stick of dynamite under the American mortgage owner and homeowner, too, because we believe that, like Bill Gates, we're chasing to be the first trillionaire, because instead of having a pure gold toilet seat, we want a gold toilet seat encrusted with diamonds. That's our goal, Steve Schwarzman. He wants a gold toilet seat encrusted with diamonds. Why? I mean, get real. I mean, you know, you're supposed to be a human being, not a freaking tapeworm crawling up the global sphincter. Come be a human being, Schwarzman.
Okay, well, again, let's go back to the original purpose of these GSEs, these government-sponsored entities like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The original purpose was they were founded to promote homeownership by subsidizing it, homeownership, with at first implicit and since the financial crisis explicit government-guaranteed mortgages. But this deal represents a big shift. Now, in a delicious Wall Street irony, the government subsidizes the largest landlords and enhances their profits from renting out single-family homes that individual homeowners had lost during the housing collapse and foreclosure crisis. And of course, they're being WallStreet.com is being quite nice there, because the financial crisis was, of course, a fraud crisis. It was all the financialization was fraud, and that caused the housing crisis, that caused the collapse, and now they never lose; they always win.
Well, you know, there's a certain limit to how many times you can bail out the same people before you destroy the currency, destroy the dollar in this case, destroy confidence. And then you get into hyperinflation, you get into a situation like Venezuela. And at the end of the day, people like Schwarzman, if 50 million Americans became slaves overnight because of his irresponsible financial malfeasance, he wouldn't care. So slavery has been outlawed. And this guy is, I think, committing borderline criminal acts.
Well, so let's turn and look at the actual properties that have been sold since the financial crisis, 2008. You have three huge entities own vast swathes of the single-family homes in America, which used to be, prior to the financial crisis, it used to be mom-and-pop sort of organizations own those, because it's very difficult to take care of. It's an expensive procedure to own single properties all over the United States and take care of them and maintain them and replace the sewage system, paint the walls, do sort of stuff like that. So evictions by Wall Street mega landlords soar. Financialization of rents caused housing instability. And this is not coming from an activist, but it's coming from the Atlanta Fed. Their study found that it's the mega landlords causing instability in the housing market in Atlanta, because you see all these evictions in Atlanta by the largest Wall Street lenders. Number one is Colony in terms of their evictions. 30% of their rentals have had eviction filings filed against them. Then American Homes for Rent, Havenbrook, all single family homes, and Invitation Homes. Invitation Homes is actually one of the lower ones. That's Blackstone Group. What the Atlanta Fed said is they blame Ben Bernanke in particular. They said Ben Bernanke is the one that devised this policy. He's the one that encouraged Blackstone Group and other private equity groups to buy up the foreclosed homes that were foreclosed upon, sometimes fraudulently, back in 2008. And the house prices were underwater because of fraud in the private equity market and the derivatives market. So they're saying that it was Ben Bernanke's policy that undermined Atlanta and perhaps other cities across America.
Well, this the Blackstone move in cahoots with Fannie Mae and the federal government is essentially financial Kristallnacht. And this is at a moment in history when people should have risen up more aggressively against the opposing forces. People should aggressively rise up against this immediately, because otherwise we know how this story ends. It's very depressing. I hope that the bell is rung and we don't have a repeat of that particularly ugly part of history.
So, as I was saying, that they're saying that their eviction rates are very high for these mega landlords because they're willing and able to. They don't know the individual renters. They just, like, whip out those eviction filings rapidly. But also on top of that, then there's the expense of housing, which has soared thanks to the Fed's efforts to heal the housing market. According to the report, 53.4% of renters were cost-burdened in Atlanta in 2014. More generally, homeownership has declined to a 51-year low, and demand for rentals has caused urban rents to increase sharply. So there you go. You know, a program and a system of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac created to help the citizen of America is helping these plunderers, and it's causing instability.
Well put. Again, the plunderers. Hey, don't go away. Stay.
Well, there you go. Now, how come all these people on the Jew left aren't demonstrating and trying to burn down the Blackstone Corporation building? The head man is Schwartzman. He's probably a Jew, but you don't have to be a Jew to be a bastard. It's just easier. How come these people having all these riots and demonstrations for Mickey Mouse reasons? Why don't they go after the really big criminals like this Blackstone Corporation? And everybody knows they're rotten to the core. And they're stealing the houses from the public and all of that kind of stuff through credit manipulation. How come nobody ever goes after these people? I think the game is a little fixed, don't you? A lot of these guys, I guess they're told who to demonstrate against. And the people they're going to demonstrate against, in most cases, don't have the power or the control to do anything. They're told what to do by the ruling class. Oh, guess what? Pepperdine University used to be one of the most conservative schools in the country, out in California on a beautiful campus. Has just removed the Christopher Columbus statue from their college lawn. Interesting, huh? Christopher Columbus is too... They're embarrassed by having Christopher Columbus on there. Oh, boy. Based on that, the country will gradually become a total rental country. Everything will be rented, and it'll be like the old days with the knights and the kings and so forth, and the peasants will have to pay high rates for rent. I've seen high rates all over the country already. It's unbelievable. Blame Blackstone and blame the politicians who kiss up to Blackstone Corporation. Boy, the Times, the Times magazine hates most of these right-wingers, but that shouldn't make you feel better, because I don't trust the right-wingers either, but these people go way overboard in degrading so-called right-wingers. Listen to this about Steve Bannon, who is from Breitbart, and now he's working directly with Trump. The outsized importance given to the head... They got a picture of him here. The outsized importance given to the head and hand serves another purpose here. Notice the incredibly tight composition of the photograph. Bannon is inescapable. He fits almost the entire frame, and outside of him there is nothing. We have nothing else to distract our gaze. We must concentrate entirely on the face and the hands. So what do we see? First, we must note the physical degradation in Bannon's face, the pockmarked skin, the discoloration of the left side of his nose, the bullfroggish eyes, mouth, and bloat. I don't mean to be a ghast or simply to shame Bannon for his appearance. Of course you do. You do, you lying son of a bitch. Nor do I mean to suggest the physical degradation implies moral degradation as well. Well, why don't you do that to some big shot nigger, some nigger actress or something? Show their ape-like face and their ape-like nose. And if they show the whole body, the ape-like body, you know. These guys are really something else, and they certainly are. They have become a party of themselves, manipulated by the ruling class. That's the media. The media is one of the biggest problems we have. That's why, at least on the internet, on the web, you can get some things that are not so screwed up. But it's pretty screwed up already, too. They're part of that on Bannon from Time Magazine. Let's see here. Nor do I mean to suggest his physical degradation always implies moral degradation as well. That being said, physical ugliness has long been an aesthetic marker of immorality. Just look at any portrayal of the devil with medieval art. In relation to Bannon, we might turn to the philosopher Peter Carmichael's words in the sense of ugliness. There is a psychic tympanum in which the ugly and the immoral both strikes, each resounding through the other. That's just he goes on through the whole article like this, tearing a guy apart for his looks. Try it on a Negro or a Jew. I mean, you know, you can easily do it on them, but you won't ever do it, will you? Racial separatists should always understand how rotten the media is. The fourth estate, as Jerry Brown used to call it. They're filthier than most other places. And free speech? If free speech means that we have to put up with the corporate media in this country, I'd almost give up free speech to get rid of them. They certainly have never done me any favors. If they put you on the media, they're going to tear you apart. So what's the benefit of going on the media? I used to think there was a benefit to it, that part of the words would leak through to the right people, but that's turned out to be bullshit. And the Bloomberg Business Week magazine had a big cover showing Bannon, Steve Bannon, the arch so-called neo-Nazi right-winger. He talks against the racists all the time and talks against Nazism all the time. Shows a picture of him and it says, "The vast right-wing conspirator." Yeah. Let's get started where I left off yesterday on this particular article. Let's see here. It is time for plain, honest speaking. It is time to write the truth, regardless of the consequences. Remember, this was printed in 1998. The truth is that we Aryans must now take part in a war which other races have both knowingly and unknowingly declared against us, and which they are already fighting. The truth is that the invasion of our Aryan fatherlands, our Aryan homelands, is a racial declaration of war by non-Aryan races. They have invaded our territory and our lands. They are expanding at our expense. Gangs of them are now trying to control the streets of our lands and carve out their own territories, which they rule. So it is that these Negro and Asian gangs are trying to intimidate Aryans. And they are, as the members of these gangs actively hate Aryans and wish to humiliate them. These gangs are now actually laughing at us, for they have sensed how tame, how domesticated, how weak and cowardly the majority of Aryan men have become. To do anything other than fight in this war for the holy cause of the Aryan survival and Aryan freedom is sheer cowardice. It is dishonorable and un-Aryan. To do anything now other than fight is to live and act as a subhuman. It is to be weak. The truth is that we need to reclaim our lands. The truth is that our race now needs a revolutionary political movement behind which our race can unite and which can show by example what our Aryan nature really is. It is warlike. It is superior. The time for playing safe political games by the rules of our Zionist enemies is over. What we do not need is an ordinary political party, for we must now change the white man's thinking and help him recover his ancient courage. There must now be a holy war against our enemies, for these enemies are threatening our very racial existence, as they and their allies are intent on taming the Aryan race and keeping it enslaved. The truth is that we Aryans are the superior race. Other races are inferior to us in what matters: in courage, in heroism, in inventiveness, in reason, in nobility, and in honor. Other races lack our Aryan sense of fairness, our Aryan sense of natural justice. Other races lack our Aryan sense of honor and our ability to reason. When we Aryans are true to our own Aryan nature, our honorable warrior nature, we are invincible. We have dominated other races in the past, created civilizations and empires because of our Aryan nature, because we are prepared to die rather than to submit, because we are prepared to fight to the last man, because we can be, if necessary, utterly ruthless when our blood is boiling, and because we can outwit and outfight our enemies in battle and in combat. It is natural, necessary, and healthy that we should be intolerant towards other races. It is natural, necessary, and healthy that we should be prejudiced against them and not wish to mix with them or live among them or even near them. It is natural, necessary, and healthy for us to be proud of our own race, our own racial heritage, and the racial achievements of our ancestors. The truth is that such intolerance and such prejudice against other races is not brutish bigotry, but the natural response to a healthy, vigorous race to an invader. This response is exactly what happens when the healthy cells of our individual bodies detect an invading and harmful organism like a virus and react to it. They defend the body and seek to destroy or repel or triumph over the invading organism. If they fail in this battle, the body falls ill and may die. If they succeed, the body recovers and is healthy and strong again. The feared and suppressed truth of these times we live in is just that our own race, our own unique folk, is a living organism. Thus, when we defend our own race, our own racial health, by fighting those who are invading our fatherlands, who are invading the living body of our folk, then we're doing what is natural, necessary, and healthy. We're doing what is civilized and wise. To do otherwise is to be weak and ill. Then that is unnatural. It is against nature herself. It is those who encourage such things as race mixing and who seek to outlaw such things as racial hatred and racial discrimination who are unnatural, uncivilized, and brutish. The truth is that our Zionist enemies want us as Aryans to be sick and ill. They want us to be tame and servile. Thus have they created the type of society we have today, with its materialistic values and its obsessions with wealth, power, comfort, and sex. Thus have these Zionists had their tame politicians and their lackeys introduce repressive racial hatred, public order, and criminal justice laws, which are intended to mentally and spiritually castrate the Aryan race. These laws have been designed and are enforced to control us, to make us ill. They have been designed to suppress the natural, healthy response of our folk to an invasion by other races. They have been designed to undermine, suppress, and destroy our natural, healthy warrior nature, our warrior intolerance, our warrior hatred, our lust for battle, our Aryan honor. The truth is that our Zionist enemies and their lackeys and allies have used and are using non-Aryan races to destroy Aryan civilization, our Aryan society, and our Aryan race itself. These invading races are the conscripted armies which the Zionist generals far from the front line command and which they exploit and use to achieve Zionist goals. The uniform of the soldier is this Zionist invasion force, is the color of their skin. There has been a wave after wave of the invasion, and little real Aryan resistance to these invasions. So tame, so domesticated, so cowardly, and so weak have the majority of Aryans become. There has been little resistance, in fact, that the Zionist generals have been able to establish occupation governments in Aryan lands with the help and assistance of hundreds of thousands of Aryan traitors and Zionist agents who have done and who are doing what the Zionists want them to do in Aryan lands. The weapons used by this invasion force are both ancient and modern. The ancient weapons, used mostly by the frontline street gangs, are barbaric violence, intimidation, fear, and the occupation of Aryan territory. The main modern weapon is slow racial genocide, the slow destruction of the Aryan race through its ever-decreasing pure Aryan birth rate, through an ever-increasing non-Aryan birth rate, and through assimilation, race mixing with the invaders. Make no mistake, this new weapon of slow racial genocide is just as deadly, just as destructive as a modern atomic bomb. The body of our Aryan folk is slowly but surely dying, just as an individual slowly but surely dies when exposed to a deadly amount of atomic radiation. Since these foreigners are in an invasion force, since there is now a war, and since we do live under a tyrannical Zionist occupational government, we have no choice but to actively fight for our freedom, our race, our lands. We must fight the non-Aryan invaders who have settled in our lands. We must fight the Aryan traitors in our midst who have betrayed our race. We must fight those who fraternize with the invaders. We must fight anyone who sides with the enemy, who enforces the tyrannical anti-Aryan laws of the enemy, or who does any work for the enemy. We must also severely deal with anyone who betrays us or our holy cause. In these desperate tyrannical times, there is one simple rule: anyone who upholds the Aryan values, who champions the Aryan race, is our ally, and anyone who upholds or champions what is un-Aryan is our sworn enemy. As will be explained, racism is the will of nature. It is natural and necessary for us to hate, just as racism itself is natural and necessary and good. It is natural and necessary, and indeed a moral duty, for us both as individuals and collectively as a folk or a race to feel hatred towards enemies and those people or those things which are harmful to us. Hatred is an aid to survival. Our moral duty, our natural duty as a people, as a folk or race, is to survive, to prosper, and to evolve, for it is race mixing, and thus the destruction of the race, which is the ultimate evil. Race mixing is a crime against life itself. It is a crime against nature, for race is how nature works. Race is how nature is manifest in us and us. Race is evolution in the action. Race is an expression of life. Race expressed simply is the ultimate meaning of our lives. For the true and natural purposes of our lives as individuals is to aid our own race, aid its unique destiny, and help our race evolve still further. The ultimate purpose of our individual lives is not, as the ignorant and deluded believe, to simply indulge ourselves, to be happy, or to acquire possessions or wealth. Our ultimate purpose is to aid nature and those things which express or manifest nature, for we ourselves and our folk, our race, are nature. It is those who deny the existence of the human races and those who seek to destroy those races through the crime of race mixing, who are ignorant, immoral, unnatural, and evil. It is tolerance of other races which have settled or which are settling in one's own racial homeland which is unnatural and a crime against nature herself. Hatred is a means of preserving the race. It is nature's survival mechanism. Thus, those who instinctively hate foreign invaders are acting in accord with nature, while those who tolerate the invaders, who mix with them and who breed with them, are acting in an unnatural way and are destroying nature. The criminals who indulge in or who support race mixing do more damage to nature than those selfish, greedy individuals who despoil, pollute, damage, and destroy the environment for profit and commercial gain. So-called racial hatred and racism itself are natural ways of protecting her creations and protecting herself. Racism is nature's way to try to ensure that the race survives. As such, racism is an expression of what is necessary, what is moral, and what is good. The modern hate laws, which our modern politicians have introduced into modern societies, are an expression of the sickness and weakness of these politicians and these societies. Such unnatural hate laws, which, for example, make inciting a racial hatred a modern social crime, are also, most importantly, repressive and tyrannical. Such hate laws have been created and are enforced by the police and the courts to take away our fundamental right to hate our enemies and those things which are harmful to us. Such hate laws have taken away our natural and necessary fundamental freedom to hate our enemies. Such hate laws have been created and are enforced to tame and domesticate us, to make us weak and ill and unable to defend ourselves against our enemies. The truth is that our modern societies are the creation of those who are and who have been the enemies of nature, the enemies of life itself. These enemies have socially engineered these modern, unnatural, and immoral societies by introducing what are tyrannical laws and tyrannical social policies designed to encourage and to enforce the natural crime, the evil, the vice of race mixing. For decades, the evil enemies of nature have tried to indoctrinate, to mentally condition people, to brainwash them into accepting the unnatural and the evil lie that all races are equal, and into accepting the evil lie that racial difference is only a matter of color of a person's skin. The truth, heretically and suppressed in these tyrannical times of ours, is that races are very different, and these differences are natural and necessary. Furthermore, these racial differences are fundamental, and they have to do with character and identity, with soul, and with destiny. These fundamental differences express who we are as individuals are and what our purpose, our destiny is. To ignore these differences or trying to destroy them through the crime of race mixing is to undermine or destroy nature's purpose. For decades, the evil enemies of nature who have socially engineered our modern race-mixing societies have tried to undermine and destroy Aryan racial awareness, Aryan pride, Aryan culture, and Aryan identity. To do this, to weaken, enslave, and try to destroy the Aryan race, they invented and used sociological myth of racism is wrong. Thus have they and those knowingly or unknowingly doing their evil, unnatural work, tried to make Aryans feel guilty about their own natural and healthy racial instincts. However, in our modern socially engineered societies, to be racist is to have instincts and pride, or hate of a racist is to act in accord with the natural will of nature. It is nature's will, nature's purpose or intent for us to discriminate against other races, and to want to place our own people first. It is nature's will, nature's intent for us to be proud of our race, our own racial culture, and the intolerance of other races and their cultures. It is nature's will, nature's intent for us to fight. if necessary, ruthlessly those people, those races, and those things which would take away and suppress or destroy our own racial identity and our unique and special racial destiny, our will to survive, flourish, and evolve as a separate race. It is nature's will, nature's intent, for each race to have its own homeland, to own separate fatherland, where it can survive, flourish, and evolve. We must never forget and never tire of saying to others that racism is the will of nature, and that race mixing is the ultimate crime against nature, the ultimate evil. Those of our people who encourage race mixing and who persecute races are either ignorant fools unknowingly doing the bidding of the evil enemies of nature, or they do not really care about nature and life because they are too busy indulging themselves and too busy trying to find a mythical personal happiness. Racism is an expression of evolution, of the urge towards difference, towards higher life. Racism expresses the instinct to preserve difference, identity, destiny. Racism expresses the natural, honorable duty an individual has to their own folk, to their own race, and to the destiny of that race. As such, racism is civilized, while race mixing is the ultimate act of dishonorable selfishness. Race mixing is a neglect of duty and a neglect of nature. Because of this, race mixing is an act of subhuman decadence and a return to barbarism. Well, let's close out with a little more reading from Statecraft on the activities during World War II on both sides of the Atlantic. Morgenthau, Kaufman, and Barr-Zohar documents. The Internal Security Subcommittee of the United States Senate Committee on the Judiciary has recently published a series of documents which present-day detailed information on the extraordinary activities of the Secretary of Treasury during the crucial years of 34 to 45. Henry Morgenthau, Jr., these documents are of the utmost interest, for they unveil the whole secret history of the foreign policy of the American government during this period. Entitled The Morgenthau Diary, published by the U.S. Government Printing Office in Washington in November 67, the documents are published in a work which consists of two enormous volumes of a total of some 1,650 pages, dealing exclusively with American policy with regard to the war. Germany and Europe, and they were prepared by the subcommittee to investigate the administration of the Internal Security Act and other internal security laws of the Committee of the Judiciary. As the foreword, the publication itself states, Dr. Anthony Kubek, professor of history at Dallas University and head of its history department, acted as a consultant to the subcommittee in the selection of the documents, has written an introduction to place events recounted in the diary items in their proper historical perspective. The Kubek analysis is regarded as both brilliantly presented and historically sound, and the subcommittee is proud to offer these additional portions of the Morgenthau Diaries, together with Dr. Kubek's introduction, for the information of the Senate. This analysis is some 81 pages long, and is in the following pages I shall give a resume of Dr. Kubek's findings, quoting extracts from the most important passages. The Morgenthau Diaries, Dr. Kubek informs us, run to 864 numbered volumes, with additional unnumbered volumes, bringing the total to 900 volumes. Each contains about 300 pages in all. There are approximately 1 million words of transcripts and conversations among high-ranking Treasury officials. The documents in the present volume deal primarily with the Treasury Department's policy towards Germany during World War II and its immediate post-war period. This data not only serves as a historical purpose regarding events prior to and during Second World War, but also indicates the serious problem of a cabinet department exceeding its jurisdiction by presuming to make foreign policy as a result of unauthorized, uncontrolled, and often dangerous power exercised by non-elected officials. A footnote at this point states that Morgenthau himself recognized the potential usefulness of the diaries. A week after his resignation in July 1945, he discussed with his aides the question of what to do with the diaries. Assistant Secretary Dan Bell warned that there was material in the diaries embarrassing to many individuals, because we have talked quite frankly in our conferences about a lot of people. Morgenthau's secretary, Mrs. H. Klotz, agreed. The Treasury attorney, Anthony J. Peel, was worried that the Republicans, if they got in and began investigating the Roosevelt regime, might subpoena the diaries. He advised, therefore, that the diaries be carefully edited and the personal and flippant material deleted. This, he told Morgenthau, would be in your own interest, in the public interest. These documents, therefore, published by the government of the United States, bear an absolutely indisputable stamp of official authenticity, and they reveal the enormous influence which his Jewish advisors, Bernard Baruch, H. Morgenthau Jr., Harry Dexter White, and others exercised on President Roosevelt. At a crucial epoch in history of the world, a group of Jews in political circles succeeded in secretly orienting the foreign policy of the United States. And they planned a major role in the development of events in Europe. It is not stating it too strongly to say that it was a question of Secretary of Treasury Morgenthau surrounding himself by exclusively Jewish collaborators and advisors, pursuing a policy which was dictated purely by Jewish concerns and without for one moment caring about the American interests. Profiting from the friendship which existed between himself and President Roosevelt, Morgenthau completely exceeded his position, and although he was really only Secretary of Treasury, he nevertheless took control of the American foreign policy during the years of 34 to 35, ignoring the ministers of war and State Department, who were normally the properly qualified men to handle these affairs, but who were powerless to oppose him, and who sometimes were quite simply ignorant of the decisions which had been taken in secret by Morgenthau and Roosevelt. A most notable example of the instance was the famous Quebec Conference, where decisions vital to the future of Europe were taken to Roosevelt and Churchill. The only others present were Morgenthau, Harry Dexter White, who was proved later to be a communist, or Stinson and Hull. The ministers of war and the State Department were carefully excluded. How many people remember that the abolition of diplomatic secrecy had been formulated by Wilson in 1918, when president of the USA, as one of the most essential bases of democracy? Quote, before Morgenthau was appointed Secretary of the Treasury, he had lived near Roosevelt's home in Hyde Park, New York, for two decades, and could be counted as one of his closest and most trusted friends, unquote. It is this friendship which explains his nomination to the Treasury and the enormous influence which he exerted throughout the whole war upon American foreign policy. The conduct of American foreign policy today consumes such a large share of the annual budget that Secretary of Treasury and his financial experts automatically become involved in diplomatic decisions of all kinds. In Roosevelt's time, however, Secretary Morgenthau's deep involvement in the questions of international significance sorely annoyed other cabinet members and created considerable friction with the State Department. In his memoirs, Secretary of State Cordell Hull described it in these terms, quote, emotionally upset by Hitler's rise and his persecution of the Jews, Morgenthau often sought to induce the president to anticipate the State Department or to act contrary to our better judgment. We sometimes found him conducting negotiations with foreign governments, which were the function of the State Department. His work in drawing up the catastrophic plan for the post-war treatment of Germany and inducing the plan for post-war treatment of Germany and inducing the president to accept it without consultation with the State Department was an outstanding example of this influence. Elsewhere in his memoirs, Hull acknowledges that Morgenthau was an able administrator with an excellent organization headed by Harry Dexter White, the communist. Actually, it was Harry Dexter White, Morgenthau's principal advisor. On money, monetary matters, and finally, Assistant Secretary of Treasury, who conducted much of the important business of the department. The diaries reveal that White's influence was enormous throughout the years of World War II. So you had Roosevelt surrounded by Jews and communists, and communist Jews. Shortly after Morgenthau became secretary in 1934, White joined his staff as an economic analysis on the recommendation of the noted economist Professor Jacob Viner of the University of Chicago. In 1938, the position of Director of Monetary Research was created for him, and in the summer of 1941, he was given the additional title and duties of Assistant to the Secretary Articulate Mustachioed and Natalie Dressed. He was a conspicuous figure in the Treasury, but remained unknown to the public until 1943, when newspaper articles identified him as the actual architect of the Secretary Morgenthau's monetary proposals for post-war period. Quote, the diaries reveal White's technique of domination over general Treasury affairs by submitting his plans and ideas to the secretary, who frequently carried them directly to the president. It is very significant that Morgenthau had access to the president more readily than any other cabinet member. He ranked beneath the Secretary of State in the cabinet, but Hull complained that he often acted through a clothed with authority to shape the course of foreign policy. Quote, over the years, White brought into the Treasury and into other branches of government a number of economic specialists with whom he worked very closely. White and his colleagues were in a position, therefore, to exercise on American foreign policy influence, which diaries reveal to have been profound and unprecedented. They used their power in various ways to design and promote the so-called Morgenthau Plan for the post-war treatment of Germany. Their power was not limited to the authority officially delegated to them. Rather, it was inherited in their access to and influence upon Secretary Morgenthau and other officials, and in opportunities they had to present or withhold information on which the policies of their superiors might be based. What makes this unique chapter in American history is that Dr. White and several of his colleagues, the actual architects of vital national policies during these crucial years, were subsequently identified as in congressional hearings as participants in a network of communist espionage in the very shadow of the Washington Monument. Two of them, Frank Coe and Solomon Adler, have been for some years working for the Chinese Communists in Asia. From the Morgenthau diaries, we can glean many details of extensive political espionage and operations by this group, especially in the area of policy subversion. These operations, Dr. Kubek continues, were first estimated by Elizabeth Bentley and Whitaker Chambers in testimony before the House Committee on Un-American Activities in the summer of 1948. in the hearings before the Senate Internal Subcommittee on operations of a communist group within the Institute of Pacific Relations, White's name came up repeatedly. Subsequently, when the subcommittee dealt with the interlocking subversion in government departments, its hearing revealed additional data on White's activities and his connection with members of a conspiratorial communist group operating within the government. Dr. White was the center of all this activity. His name was used for reference by members of the espionage ring when they made application for federal employment. He arranged their transfer from bureau to bureau, from department to department. He assigned them to international missions. He vouched for their loyalty and protected them when exposure threatened. When former communist courier Elizabeth Bentley appeared before the subcommittee in 1952, she painted a startling picture of the fundamental design of communist penetration. One of the two espionage groups that she handled in Washington was headed by Nathan Gregory Silvermaster, another Jew, an official of the Treasury Department. Concerning the avenues for placing people in strategic positions, she said, "Two of our best ones were Harry Dexter White and Lachlan Curry. They had an immense amount of influence and knew people, and their word would be accepted when they recommended someone." Curry, a Canadian-born Harvard economist, fled the United States after testifying one time before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. He has lived for years in Colombia, but once had enjoyed access to the inner circle of the Roosevelt administration. He came to Washington in 1934, first to the Treasury, and then to the Federal Reserve Board. In 1939, Curry was appointed as one of the six administrative assistants to the President with special duties in economics. With Curry in the White House and White in the Treasury, stages were set for the development of what Secretary Hull has called the catastrophic program for the post-war disposition of Germany, which came to be known as the Morgenthau Plan. Stating in its simplest terms, the objective of the Morgenthau Plan was to deindustrialize Germany and diminish its people to a pastoral existence once the war was won. If this could be accomplished, the militaristic Germans would never rise again to threaten the peace of the world. This was the justification for all the planning. But another motive lurked behind the obvious one. Hidden motive was unmasked in a syndicated column in the New York Herald Tribune in September 46, more than a year after the collapse of the Germans. The real goal of the proposed condemnation of all of Germany to a permanent diet of potatoes was the communization of the defeated nation. The best way for the German people to be driven into the arms of the Soviet Union, it was pointed out, was for the United States to stand forth as the champion of indiscriminate and harsh misery in Germany. And so it seemed, for a recent speech, Foreign Minister Molotov had declared the hope of the Soviet Union to transform Germany into a democratic, peace-loving state, which besides its agriculture will have its own industry and foreign trade. Did Russia really plan on becoming the savior of a prostrate Germany from the vengeful fate which the United States had concocted for them? If this was indeed a hidden motive in the Morgenthau Plan, what can be said of the principal planner, which this motive of Harry Dexter White? Was White acting as a communist but without specific instructions? Was he acting as a communist but without acting as a communist Soviet agent when he drafted the plan? There was no confession in the Morgenthau diaries in which White admits that he was either ideologically a communist or actively a Soviet agent. But it is possible, given an understanding of the Soviet aims in Europe, to reconstruct from the diaries how White and certain of his associates of the Treasury worked assiduously to further those aims. From the diaries, therefore, it is possible to add significant evidence to the testimonies of J. Edgar Hoover and Anthony General Herbert Brownell and Harry Dexter White was ideologically a communist and actively a Soviet agent from the day he entered the service of the United States government. Before the entrance of the United States into World War II, Secretary Morgenthau's principal efforts were directed at arming allies against Japan and Germany. Perhaps no individual was more committed to assisting the Allies or more ardently in furthering the national defense than Morgenthau. At times, Secretary Hall was fearful that Morgenthau's crusading fervor might provoke the Axis nations too far. The diaries show sharp disagreements between the State and Treasury departments in the administration of export controls and foreign funds on deposit in the United States. Morgenthau early initiated a struggle to wrest from the State Department its traditional authority over exports and imports of war material in the hopes of bringing the Office of Arms and Munitions Control under his department. The Secretary of Treasury had a strong personal taste for diplomatic bargaining and was frequently engaged in discussions with ambassadors or in correspondence with foreign statesmen, activities which, of course, were properly the function of the Secretary of State. Hull warmly resented what he regarded as unwarranted interference in the field of foreign affairs. And that's about all I have time for today, boys and girls, and we'll get back into this maybe next week. It's a little dry right now, but this is to show you how our government was totally taken over by Jews and communists back in the day before World War II, and how they worked to get us into a hot war with Germany and Japan and all that stuff. So it just didn't get rotten. It just didn't get that way. Just didn't happen. It's been that way for a long time.